Okay, well, good to have you with us for a new quarter of study here in the auditorium class, as we affectionately call it. We're going to be studying, actually the next two quarters, we're going to be studying the book of Genesis. So part one, we're covering roughly the first half of the book this quarter, and then we'll finish that in the winter quarter that begins in December. And what I want to do today, before I say that, if you haven't picked up one of the workbooks yet, the yellow workbook, there are plenty of those in the back on the table, so feel free to avail yourselves of that. We'll actually be starting the lessons in the workbook on Wednesday night. We're doing kind of just a general introduction to the book of Genesis this morning, we're going to just talk about a few basic things. I see, Charlie. Let's go ahead and do this. If you don't have a copy of the workbook, hold up your hand if you need one. Charlie will get you one. I know a lot of people got them Wednesday night. We've got plenty more. Oh, need one over here. Almost everybody's got one. All right, very good. Well, tell me what you know about the book of Genesis. Let's just start there. Will?
The creation of everything.
Okay.
The beginning of everything.
Okay. All right. It is. How does the book start? What are the first three words in the book?
In the beginning.
Yeah, that's usually how we characterize it. The Hebrews were not often very creative in naming the books of the Bible. With the books of the Pentateuch, what they often did was they would just call the book by the opening words. And so in Hebrew, Genesis begins Bereshit, and that's the name that they gave to the book, in the beginning. So, you know, they would tell you, hey, turn in your scrolls to in the beginning. I don't know if that's how they said it, but... That was how they identified, but that highlights the fact that it's about the beginnings of things. The word Genesis that we call it by comes from the title that the book was given in the Septuagint and other Greek translations of the Old Testament. And it has to do with origins, the beginning of things. We're going to read in Genesis about the beginning of creation. We're going to read about that in chapter 1. We're going to read about the beginning of humanity, particularly in chapter 2. We're going to read about the origins of sin in chapter 3. We're going to read about, in that same chapter, some of the first hints of God's plan for rescuing man from sin. And the longer Genesis goes, the more we see glimpses of that plan start to unfold. Chapter 4, we're going to see the origins, the very first record of worship, Cain and Abel. We'll talk about that. And then some of the progress that humanity makes through the genealogies in chapter 5. We'll say a word about that. There are several genealogies, lists of family lines in Genesis. And usually when we are reading, we just try, if you're just reading casually or for enjoyment, you either skip those or blow through them as quickly as possible, because it's just this list of really long names. It's a really long list of really long names. But there are some significant things that are revealed in several of those, and we'll have occasion to talk about that as we go through. We're going to talk a little bit later about some other important concepts that are introduced to us in Genesis, but it's a book of origins. What else? What else can you tell me about it? Mark? Right, right. Excellent observations, and those are things we're going to key in on a lot as we study through this book. Since Mark mentioned that, let me talk just a little bit about the layout of the book. We'll talk about some other things. In the first, there's a lot of ways you could outline or divide Genesis, but for purposes of thinking about it this morning, I've really just split it into two parts. The first 11 chapters, and then chapters 12 through 50. The first 11 chapters tell us about the beginnings of the created world. We were just talking about that, the origins of a number of important things that we were just discussing. Chapter 12 introduces us, of course, to Abraham and God's singling out Abraham and making specific promises to him that have long-lasting repercussions. And so you have from that point the beginnings of the chosen people. You have the origins of Israel as a nation, how that comes about. One writer said Genesis 1 through 11 is primarily concerned with man's predicament. I mean, things do not really go very well for most of that part of Scripture. Well, things are great in chapters 1 and 2. But after chapter 3, you have a lot recorded about mankind's wickedness. Of course, that culminates in the great flood of Noah's time that wipes mankind out, with the exception of Noah and his family, and we start over, and right away, there's wickedness again. There's rebellion against God. Well, in chapter 12, you have God's promise. You have really the beginnings of God working out His plan of redemption, His plan of bringing into the world the Christ. Of course, that's hundreds of years in the future from the time frame of Genesis chapter 12, but that's where we see that begin to unfold. You have four pivotal events in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. You have, of course, the creation, including the creation of man and woman. You have the fall. You have what we often call the fall, the entry of sin into the world through the disobedience of Adam and Eve. And then, of course, the flood, a pivotal event geologically and in lots of other ways, and you have God essentially starting over with mankind and reiterating some important promises to Noah in the wake of that, and the dispersion that takes place in chapter 11. A dispersion that really probably should have taken place voluntarily earlier in Genesis, but was kind of forced upon man by the confusion of languages. In chapter 11, that's the Tower of Babel story. And so you have mankind filling the earth, and you have the origins in chapters 10 and 11 of a lot of the different nationalities and ethnic and racial makeup of the world as it is today, beginning there. In contrast to that, in chapters 12 to 50, the focus is on four pivotal people. Abraham, of course, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Those four patriarchs. And of course, there are other members of their family that are highlighted, and there are other people that they interact with that are highlighted in these chapters, but the focus, because they are the focus of God's promises, the focus of the narrative is on these four patriarchs. If I have time today, I'm going to talk a little bit about the lifestyle of the patriarchs, but I'll save that for a little bit later. What else can you tell me about the book of Genesis? Shane. Yeah, that is an important observation anytime we are reading a historical book of Scripture. And it begins in the very first one, Genesis. It's a great observation to make about the book of Genesis, is that you see God accomplishing His purposes in spite of all of man's faults and foibles, and sometimes even man's deliberate attempts to thwart God's purposes. You still see God working out His plan. Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along. Willie.
If you think about what Genesis is to the Old Testament, when you
Yeah, that's a good comparison. Yeah, it's a good way to think of things. And that brings me to a question I wanted to ask, and then I'll get Mark's comment. I'm not going to talk a whole lot about the authorship of Genesis today. There are all kinds of theories from liberal Bible scholars about the authorship, not just of Genesis, but of the entire Pentateuch, the first five books of the Old Testament, that are based, like a lot of theories of authorship are, they're based on an attempt to be mind readers of the guys who wrote the Bible rather than just taking the text as it is. The overwhelming Jewish and Christian tradition, which I think is correct, has been that Moses is the author of not just Genesis, but the entirety of the Pentateuch, with maybe a few editorial comments about, say, Moses' death inserted in a few places. Going on that assumption, let me ask this question. Why, assuming that this book was written by Moses in the 15th century BC, why did God see fit to reveal it and have it written at that time? Why did the book of Genesis need to be written? Well, 15th century BC, roughly. The 1400s BC. And you can even broaden it out, why would anybody need the book of Genesis? Mark? Okay. Okay. Yeah, I think that's very important. Go ahead, Luke.
If you look at one of the main gripes, or one of the big gripes as far as in our schooling, it's we're losing teaching history, and kids don't even know what happened in our nation, or even be able to relate to where we are now, where we started. And people could go along, and they could be talking about God without that background of knowing what all God is, that's important to bring to where they are.
Okay. Yeah, those two observations together, very important. And I think they help us see in the immediate circumstance of the people of Israel why they needed the book of Genesis. During Moses' lifetime, remember, what's the situation of the people of Israel? Okay, yeah. I mean, when Moses is born, the people of Israel are in slavery in Egypt. Yeah, that's right. They don't really know who they are in a lot of them don't. That's right. And of course, Moses is appointed by God to lead them out of that situation, and not only that, but to bring them to the place where God makes a covenant with them, establishes them as a nation, reaffirms these promises that He is going to give them a land to dwell in. These are all things that are continuations of promises that God originally made to the patriarchs in Genesis. And you can see it being very helpful to the people of Israel, for one thing, to know that these are not promises that God just made up just now. These are promises He made to their ancestors hundreds of years prior. His choosing them has been in His mind from eternity, for a very long time. A lot of other ways in which it's helpful for them to know where they came from, to know the origins of things. Go ahead, Debbie. Sure. Yeah. And that is an important feature, not just for the Israelites living 1,500 years before Christ, but for anybody, for us, to know that God has established His... we won't have time to cover all the aspects of this. Genesis 1 is such a powerful statement of who God is in so many ways. Establishing... One of the interesting things that Genesis 1 does not do is argue, here's why you should believe there's a God, and go into a lot of philosophy or theology. It assumes from the very first sentence that God is and that God always has been and that He has the power to do the things described. Well, the Israelites needed to know that because that's the God who is calling them to be a nation. That's the God who is, that's the God who's working the plagues in Egypt. That's the God who's going to lead them to the land of promise. We need to know that too. Ural? Right.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth.
Yeah. That's right. We'll get to talk about that a little more Wednesday. But that there's so much that is packed into that creation narrative. Even not to mention the rest of the book. That's vital information. Now there's a lot that Genesis doesn't tell us because it has a particular focus. I mean These first 11 chapters cover an immense time period. Genesis covers more time than all the rest of the books of the Old Testament put together. Old and New Testament, really. From the most rigid, literal attempts to date the events of Genesis, especially going back to the creation, was it Bishop Usher who came up with the dating system that was used in a lot of Bibles? At the bare minimum, you've got 2,000 years covered in those first 11 chapters of Genesis, quite possibly more. The focus narrows down quite a bit, covering Genesis chapter 12 through 50, because now we're zeroing in on a specific family and a specific locale and all of that. Go ahead. Very, very good. That's right. That's an important thought to keep in mind as we study this book. Thanks. That's great. A lot of those same things could be said of any Old Testament book, but yeah, Genesis in particular, very good thoughts. Something else? You find some of the greatest Bible stories that there are in the book of Genesis. Stories from, the stuff we learned, if you were read children's Bible story books as a youngster, lots of those stories came from Genesis. But understand, they are not just stories. These are not just myths and fairy tales with a moral. They definitely have something to teach us. These are historical facts about real people. These are events that actually took place as God was unfolding His plan, especially His plan for providing redemption from sin. So think of that when you read about the struggles and the missteps of people like Noah and Abraham and Lot and Isaac and Jacob and others that you're going to encounter in the book. People who, very often, people whose lives are characterized as righteous and godly, but sometimes they really messed up. And God used them anyway. And that's important for us to remember. It can teach us a great deal about our limitations and about God's grace and His patience and lots of other things. Something else? All right. Let me talk about just a few key concepts that we're going to encounter in the book of Jesus, book of Genesis. Several of you have already talked about some of these, and we'll come back to some other ideas as we go along. And I lifted this list from James Smith's commentary on the Pentateuch, which I probably recommended this a time or two. James E. Smith, very conservative writer about the Old Testament, has a five-book series on the Old Testament commentaries. It is some of the most, I like to call them, user-friendly commentaries I have ever encountered. He has a knack for structuring his comments on the text in a very readable and very memorable way. And there's a lot of great information in it, but it's not written at a level that you know, a lot of readers would look at that and say, I don't get it. And I promise I'm not getting any kickbacks or profits from recommending this, but if you're looking for a really good, usable, basic commentary on the Old Testament, or just on, you know, that covers Genesis through Deuteronomy, James E. Smith's, it's published by College Press, Joplin, Missouri. Very good set. But I lifted this list from his comments, from his introduction to Genesis. These are some important concepts that Genesis presents to us. Of course, creation. We've talked about that. This is the book about the origin of everything. We will talk about God's power and nature and character as demonstrated in the creation in chapter 1 and chapter 2. The concept of sin is introduced to us, sadly, very early in the book of Genesis, chapter 3. Sin, we read about sin being encouraged by a malevolent being that we come to know in the Scriptures as Satan. He's introduced to us in the form of the serpent in Genesis chapter 3. We just finished Revelation where there's a clear identification of that serpent with Satan. And here is Satan presenting this temptation before Eve. And when we get to Genesis 3, we'll talk about the way in which he presents that and how that's characteristic of the way Satan operates. But Eve and then right after Adam, they disobey God. And, of course, a host of consequences flow from that begin to unfold in Genesis chapter 3. But through the rest of the book, sin is a problem. Especially in the first 11 chapters, like we said, sin is a huge problem. But even after that, in the lives of these righteous patriarchs, sin is a problem. It is an ever-present thing that it is manifested in heinous crimes like murder, Cain murdering Abel, Genesis chapter 4. Immorality and violence, think about the world of Noah's day as it's described in Genesis chapter 6, or the vile kinds of immorality that, say, the city of Sodom was known for in the days of Abraham and Lot. It shows itself in pride and rebellion against God. That's one of the things the Tower of Babel incident in chapter 11 illustrates for us. It is a very real problem that God immediately in chapter 3 speaks, even though He speaks very briefly and some might say very vaguely about the solution to the problem of sin in Genesis chapter 3 when He talks about the seed of woman. He still addresses it. And Mark, I think, mentioned that we are introduced to the concept of blood sacrifice in Genesis. It's not really, very little is said about why blood sacrifices were needed. You see that explained in more detail in a book like Exodus or Leviticus. But you see it as a matter of course in the lives of certainly of the patriarchs, and of course that begins with Abel in Genesis chapter 4. And that, of course, becomes a precursor of a type or a foreshadowing of the ultimate sacrifice. We're introduced to that in Genesis. Okay, judgment. Mentioned when Adam and Eve sinned against God, did he say, "Oh, that's okay. There's not going to be any consequences"? Okay, there's a whole raft of ugly things that result from their sin. You know, and we'll talk about this more when we get to that chapter. But what kinds of things happened because Adam and Eve sinned? Okay. Yeah, they lost their home. They're banished from the garden where they had enjoyed a very easy life and perfect fellowship with God. They're cut off from that. Okay. Death. Yeah. They're cut off from access to the tree of life. God had promised them, "In the day you eat from it, you will surely die." And they now face mortality. What was yours?
They started carrying around guilt. They didn't know what it was like.
Yeah. Yeah. We think about that a lot. You know, Adam and Eve, before they ate of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they had never experienced guilt. What would it be like to live a life utterly free from guilt and shame? But their shame is highlighted right away in Genesis chapter 3. Yeah, they've got to carry that around. James?
Pain and suffering.
Yeah. Pain and suffering manifested in a number of ways, hardship and hard work and all kinds of things that are introduced. Throughout the text of Genesis, there's an emphasis on the fact that sin brings consequences. God does not just turn a blind eye to it. Probably the ultimate example of that, apart from the consequences that fall on Adam and Eve, the other ultimate example of that in Genesis would be the flood, where God determines to destroy humanity except for this one righteous man and his family, because the wickedness of man has grown to be so great. And you see that starting to, as you read from chapter 3 on down toward Noah's time, you see this emphasis on multiplying evil and wickedness, fewer and fewer people acknowledging God. And so there's a consequence to that. Lots of other examples. I mean, Cain is punished for his murder of Abel. The cities of Sodom and Gomorrah are punished for their particularly acute wickedness, and other examples of that. So, right away in Genesis, we learn about divine judgment on sin. We also learn at the same time about divine grace. We learn about God's mercy. Adam and Eve, even though they are expelled from the garden, God provides them with clothing, and God provides them with a promise. The promise, ultimately, of what the seed of woman would do. Cain, even though he's banished, made a wanderer, he's given assurance that his life will be preserved. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord, the text said. Lot and his family, as imperfect as they were, are delivered from the judgment that comes against Sodom. In short, you see a lot of instances of God dealing with imperfect people far better than they deserve. In the book of Genesis, we're going to talk about the mistakes that you see in the lives of the patriarchs, for example. A lot of instances of that. Election, by that I mean God making choices, God choosing to use particular people or particular families in order to bring about His purposes. Whereas the second part of Genesis that starts with Abraham really emphasizes that. But of course, you have the choice of Noah as the one who is selected to build the ark in which humanity is going to be preserved. And of course, the animals that Noah brings aboard and all that. We'll talk about that when we get to chapter 6, chapter 7. But there's a lot about God's graciously, mercifully choosing people to use to accomplish His purposes. Promise, we're going to see so much about God making and keeping His promises to people, particularly, of course, the promises made to Abraham and his descendants. and promises made to Abraham about his descendants, that only in the most simple way even begin to be fulfilled in the book of Genesis itself. And this is one of the important things about that part of the book. You've got this promise, or really the set of promises made to Abraham. Help everybody remember what kinds of things did God promise to Abraham? All right, he promised that he promised to give to his descendants the land, in, you know, of course, the land that God had brought him to. That required another promise. He's got to have some descendants to give the land to. Yeah, I'm going to make you a great nation. Here's, remember, Abraham's this old man. He and his wife don't have any children. God says, I'm going to make a great nation of you. There's so many, they're not even going to be able to count them. What else? All right, the seed promise, as we often speak of it. That's looking forward, way forward. In your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed, pointing especially to the Messiah, Jesus. I will make your name great. Lots of important promises that God makes to Abraham. Now, by the time we get to the end of the book of Genesis, you have what? 70 people that make up the family of Israel that moves down to Egypt. That's not exactly as numberless as the sands on the seashore that God promised to Abraham. They're not a great nation yet. They don't have a land yet. You know, but by the end of the book of Genesis, Abraham has bought that plot with the cave of Machpelah to bury Sarah. And other than that, they don't own a blade of grass in the land of Canaan. None of those promises are even close to fulfillment by the end of the book of Genesis, but you can see the progress already that is made. And that goes back to our question about why did the people of Israel, who were coming out of bondage in Egypt and entering into the land of Canaan and into covenant status with God, why did they need this information? That's part of the reason. So they can see how God has been working toward the fulfillment of these promises. Well, along the way, there are threats to that, or there are at least apparent threats to the accomplishment of those purposes. There are circumstances that challenge the faith of the patriarchs. Here's Abraham. He gets the promise of a child in a situation where normally that would be impossible. And you remember how, the first time God speaks to Abraham about his descendants, I've got this guy in my household, I've designated him as my heir, God must be talking about that. God says, no, I'm talking about you having children. And remember, Sarah, his wife, has a hard time coming to terms with God's promise, and there are some attempts to help God out that don't work out very well, we'll say. More about that as we go along. And then once the son of promise is born, what's the first thing God tells Abraham to do with him? Yeah. Okay. And then there's the question of who Isaac is going to marry. Abraham is very, very concerned about that. And you have accounts of wives and mothers-to-be who are barren. And without God's intervention, these promises are not going to be fulfilled. And so there are circumstances that require great faith on the part of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and many of those who are connected with them. And we see how important that is. And we see throughout the book of Genesis, God being responsible for things happening the way they do. When you get to Hebrews, I'll get Mark in just a second. When you get to Hebrews 11, and the writer of Hebrews gives us, and we sometimes call it this great hall of faith. Almost all of them come from the book of Genesis. And they're powerful reminders of what faith does. Mark, go ahead.
I have just been thinking that I would put faith in his providence.
Yeah. Oh, look here. Yeah, here's faith. Yeah, providence didn't make Smith's list, but I think that's an important one we should add. So if you're writing these down, add an eighth one after faith. Add providence, because God's providence is all over the book of Genesis, as is the faith of these great people. Okay, yeah. You know, toward the end of Genesis, in the life of Joseph, remember Joseph's been sold into slavery and he ends up in Egypt, and through God's providence, Joseph ends up being raised to be second only to Pharaoh himself. And in that circumstance, he is reunited with his brothers, the brothers that sold him into slavery in the first place. And you remember what he says to them? He said, God sent me before you in order to preserve life. You didn't do this. God did. That's a great indicator of God's providence and Joseph's faith in it. And then what Mark mentioned, when Joseph is on his deathbed, he makes his family members promise that when, not if, when God brings them out of Egypt and brings them to the land that he promised their forefathers, you take my bones up there with you and you bury them. And of course, in the book of Exodus, we read about them doing exactly that. But that's how confident Joseph was in God's fulfilling this promise, even though, just like Isaac, his father, and Abraham, just like Jacob, his father, and Isaac, his grandfather, and Abraham, his great-grandfather, they did not live to see those promises fulfilled. They still believed in them. Wow, there's a lot we can learn from that. Questions, comments? On this, you know, brief list here. And again, add providence to that. I'm gonna go home and I'm gonna update my PowerPoint and add providence, because that's very important. Yeah. Just a little bit about the geography of Genesis. If looking at maps helps you keep things in perspective when you're studying historical books, like it does me, you have basically this is a map of the ancient Near East. You have basically three areas on which the events of Genesis unfold. The first few chapters all take place in the Mesopotamian River Valley, the Tigris-Euphrates River Valleys. Of course, the precise location of a lot of those events is uncertain, but the Tigris and Euphrates, for example, are both described as flowing through the Garden of Eden, you read about events that take place in the plain of Shinar. That's where the Tower of Babel is. All of that is in this general area, which, not incidentally, even, you know, you may have learned this if you studied ancient history and geography even a little bit in junior high or high school, they called this the cradle of civilization. Not accidentally. And then secondly, beginning with Genesis chapter 12, of course, you meet Abram in chapter 11, and he lives in Ur of the Chaldees. He lives over there in Mesopotamia, but God appears to him in Haran and tells him, you're going to go to a land that I'm going to show you, and that land, of course, is what we call the land of Canaan, or Palestine. And a large part of the events of the rest of Genesis unfold there, in what is the land of promise. And again, it's Abraham and Isaac and Jacob sojourning in this land. They don't own it, but they are resident aliens there, if you will, and become people who are highly respected by the people who do live there. And then the third stage is Egypt. At the end of the book of Genesis, of course, we talked about Joseph ending up in Egypt. And because of the economic circumstances occasioned by a famine in Canaan, Joseph brings all the rest of the family down to Egypt. So Jacob and all his sons and their wives and children end up in Egypt. That's where the book closes. So the last few chapters are unfolding there. Of course, there's a lot of focus on Joseph and his experiences there. But geographically, these are the three places where all the action happens in the book of Genesis. So just be mindful of that if you if you like to look at maps while you're talking about these historical books. All right. Go ahead, Luke. Yeah.
Do we get an indication when Abraham went back to, or went to the Palestine area, that it was like the land flowing with milk and honey at that time compared to what the Israelites were looking at today?
Yeah, Genesis doesn't say a lot about that, but I have to assume it was. That it was a prosperous and good land when Abraham sojourned there. Let me say a couple things about that. I know it's very easy. I know it always has been for me. When I read about the patriarchs sojourning in the land of Canaan, what did the patriarchs do? What did they do for a living? Yeah, they raised sheep and goats and things like that. Yeah, that sounds boring. It sounds dusty. You picture modern day Bedouin Arabs who just roam around the desert, especially in the territory between Palestine and Egypt. You know, just roaming around and having kind of a nomadic and relatively impoverished existence. And it's very easy to picture that in the lives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that's not how it was. Go ahead, Earl.
It's described in pretty good terms when Abraham traveled around the Fertile Crescent and into a land that flowed with milk and honey.
Yeah.
I mean, we think of it as a grab situation, yeah. But compared to what it could have been, it was good.
Sure. Well, and when Abraham, remember in, I think it's chapter 13, when Abram and Lot separate, Lot lifted his eyes toward the plain of the Jordan and saw that it was well-watered and fertile everywhere. And the region that's talking about is what is now the Dead Sea. That's almost defies imagination. But the text of Genesis explains this was before God destroyed the cities of the plain. Okay? Shane? Right.
Where it was desolate.
Right.
That it may not have necessarily been the same. It may have been better when it came back than it was before.
Right.
We do know that the period of time that all of that area was desolate for the famine.
Right. That's good observation. Yeah. I'll give you some more information about the lifestyle of the patriarchs as when we get to studying that. But Abraham. The Bible describes Abraham as immensely wealthy. They were like mobile cattle barons, yeah. One writer described them, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, as merchant princes. Because sheep and goats and livestock, that doesn't sound glamorous to us, but that was one of the most common mediums of economic exchange in the ancient world. And if you had a lot of it, you were rich. And Abraham did. Abraham is so wealthy, in fact, that in chapter 14, when Lot is taken captive during a military encounter, Abram is able, from his own household, to muster an army of 300 and go on a rescue mission and get Lot and his family back. And Abraham's an old man when he does this, too. That is good stuff. It's a reminder of how wealthy and how powerful these men were. God put them in that position, and God used that to accomplish His purposes. Somebody else had a hand up, I think. All right, but just be mindful of that when we are studying the age of the patriarchs. But of course, we've got a lot of other things that unfold in Genesis leading up to that. Book of Beginnings. This is where it all starts. Wednesday night, we'll open up with chapter 1. We could spend a lot of time talking about just that first chapter. We're just going to devote one class period to it. Again, if you have not yet picked up the workbook, that's the yellow workbook. There's plenty of copies on the table in the back. There are also some individual copies just of the very first lesson back there. Feel free to grab that and be ready for our discussion Wednesday. We'll be